The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to our third of four panels today. Before we go ahead with it, let me just reiterate that we still have that contest open with respect to Exemption 3 statutes, that whoever comes closest to guessing the actual number of verified true Exemption 3 statutes that we'll be revealing in our fourth panel this afternoon will win a free guided tour to the White House. And so far I can tell you, although the correct number is, of course, a three-digit number, no one has guessed within 50 yet of the correct number.
Dan, 999.
That's within 50. No. We've actually had a guess of 1,100 and of 999 and of 373 and 250. We've had a number of high guesses. No one has come within 50 yet of the actual number. So if that's any hint, there's still time. Get that guess to us and win a free Newseum guided tour. Now we're going to turn to what I call pseudo-secrecy, or it could also be referred to as agency use of safeguarding labels. This is the difficult area, the murky area, that has become increasingly of concern since 9/11, but as you'll hear from our panel today, it has antecedents prior to 9/11, where agencies designate certain documents or portions of documents as sensitive but unclassified or for official use only or law enforcement sensitive or the like. We have on the CGS website 124 such labels identified, only a half dozen of which or so actually overlap with Exemption 3 statutes. So we're talking here about designated categories of records that are not necessarily coextensive with FOIA exemption, and therein lies the tale, or part of the difficulty. And you're going to hear from this very expert panel as to where this came from, how it developed over the years, and more to the point, most importantly, where it can be expected to be going sometime very soon, which is very important for collateral matter of FOIA administration. What I'm going to do is just introduce our moderator to you. That's Sharon Bradford Franklin in the center right there. And she's a special counsel with the Constitution Project. And Sharon has worked on this area for quite some time, has, matter of fact, issued a report, I believe it was the summer of 2008. Summer of 2009. That is in part of the materials that are within your disk handouts for materials that you have available, and has worked very extensively in this area. And she is someone who, like one of our speakers this morning, graduated from both Harvard and Yale, and has been finding a very, very good, interesting career in dealing with government information policy and things that are of strong civil liberties related concern at the Constitution Project. So I will turn you over to Sharon's capable hands to then launch into this this panel, and we have at least an hour and 15 minutes or so that we can devote to that. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you, Dan. Our panel today is actually the only panel on FOIA Day that doesn't directly address FOIA. And I hope our panelists will talk about how, moving forward, we're trying to make sure that this is actually very carefully delinked from FOIA. It's covering a system of designation and a category of information that is our panelists will hopefully help to describe. I had the number by one count that there are 107 different labels. Dan just threw out the number of 124. Needless to say, there are a lot of them out there. And some of them include FOUO, or for official use only, SBU, sensitive but unclassified, and the current label that most of the government seems to be operating under right now is one called CUI, or controlled unclassified information. But in any case, it's clear that this information is unclassified, so it's not part of our classification system of, you know, top secret and so forth, but is sensitive in some way, so that some amount of safeguarding may be needed. And our panel today will talk about how that works, why it might need some safeguarding, how that works, and how we can actually promote sharing of this information to make clear that it is not indeed classified information. Dan mentioned that the Constitution Project, my organization, which is a bipartisan nonprofit organization that promotes constitutional safeguards, issued a report that you have in your materials. It's called Reigning in Excessive Secrecy, Recommendations for Reform of the Classification and Controlled Unclassified Information System. And I will not go through all 18 recommendations we make, but it does have three broad categories that we have talked about: promoting openness and limiting secrecy within the government and with the public. Second, promoting accountability within the executive branch. Third, providing for oversight and accountability by Congress and with the public. And there have been many efforts historically that you'll hear about in a moment to reform and regulate this vast category of information and how it's handled. But in the past 2 years, we've seen a particular renewed focus on this. In May of 2008, President Bush issued a memorandum seeking to impose some form of standardization and focusing in on this title of controlled unclassified information as being the term that should be used. In May of 2009, President Obama then issued a memorandum ordering a 90-day review of this category of information and moving towards some further reforms in this effort. Then in December of 2009, following up on President Obama's memorandum, the Presidential CUI Task Force issued its report, including 40 specific recommendations for reform. And moving forward from that, we understand that the administration is now working to develop what may be an executive order furthering the reform of this category of information. We also are seeing some efforts on the Hill, although there hasn't been legislation actually passed completely yet, but the House has passed a bill called H.R. 1323, Reducing Information Control Designations Act, and referred that to the Senate. So our panelists today are going to give you a bit of a historical overview and talk about how this has gone in the past and going forward and what lessons we may draw for this effort. And we'll hopefully touch on some of the following questions. What is CUI or SBU or however you describe this category of information? What is the purpose of this regime, promoting sharing, ensuring safeguarding, or some combination? And how can we ensure that this does not become a fourth level of classification? So I'd like to introduce our panelists in the order that they will be speaking in, who will give some presentations on this, and then we'll have a conversation among the panelists and then open it up, of course, to you with your questions. So our first speaker today will be Grace Mustali, who is currently the president of Ethos International Incorporated, which she co-founded in 2007 following an extensive career in the federal government in both the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security, where her work very much involved these kinds of issues. She had the responsibility while she was at the Department of Justice for development of a policy on handling what was termed then the worst case scenario information, which was the precursor to another earlier category here of sensitive homeland security information. And then as director of the DHS Information and Collaboration Office, she chaired an interagency working group on sensitive but unclassified information. Our second speaker will be Matthew Cronish, who is the Associate General Counsel for Intelligence at the Department of Homeland Security. And he is also the co-chair of the Presidential Interagency Task Force on Controlled Unclassified Information. That's the task force that issued its report in December of 2009 and is continuing to work on these issues as well, still in the government. His previous work has included serving as an officer in the U.S. Navy and as Assistant General Counsel at Tyco Telecommunications. Our third speaker today will be Jay Vasenko, who is the director of the Information Security Oversight Office, known as ISOO, and which is part of the National Archives and Records Administration. And he had been appointed in May of 2008 as the director of the Archives Controlled Unclassified Information Office. And so he carries out the responsibilities of NARA as the executive agent under the President's Memorandum of May of 2008 on designating and sharing of controlled and classified information. And he is also currently serving as the chairman of the CUI Council. Our final speaker on this panel will be Mike German, who is National Security Policy Counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union. And he works on a variety of these types of national security and transparency and information policy issues. And previously, Mike served for 16 years as a special agent at the FBI, so he can speak from the perspective of inside the government as well. So we're going to now turn to our opening presentation. So Grace first.
All right. Is this on? It sounds like I'm here because I'm old. I remember when Dan instructed me that I better not mention transparency, which was a European concept, at a White House meeting if I wanted to keep my policy job. Did anyone see last night's episode of 24? Any 24 fans here? It was remarkable to watch coming out of the counterterrorism environment because it included a wonderful scene at the CTU where an ERSAC's law enforcement person presented a data exchange request form to an analyst at CTU and stood around waiting for her to provide him immediately with the sensitive surveillance data. Talk about fiction. A more current example is I've spent 18 months trying to get my two former agencies to share information with each other, and as I'm about to be fired from that project because I've utterly failed to get them to share unclassified but controlled information with each other. I first encountered the complexity of what we call controlled unclassified information between 1984 and 1986, shortly after the Bhopal Union Carbide, I believe it was, disaster. And we soon were dealing at the Department of Justice, and Miriam probably remembers this, first with the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act, which included a document which reported on every toxic release within the United States called the Toxic Release Inventory, which later led to an amendment of the Clean Air Act where there was an attempt to balance the public right to know, the need to know, of potential vulnerabilities and risk associated with chemical information with what the FBI immediately determined was a high risk that that information could be used by terrorists. And we went into, and Miriam's got to remember this, months in 1996 and 1997 of trying to balance the need to know for clean air and safety in the community against the risk of the information being made available in the new electronic reading rooms via the internet. I'm embarrassed when I look at the solution we came up with, which was basically to make the information available in hard copy in 50 reading rooms around the country, as opposed to making it available on the internet. And yeah, you remember. the vast majority of information in these risk management plans that required of virtually every chemical manufacturer or producer in the country were posted by EPA. In fact, initially they included the worst case scenario information by accident after we had spent 2 years coming up with a legal regime for it not to be posted. I have to note that the FBI's first attempt to control this unclassified information was totally unconstitutional, and that's how I got dragged into the issue in the first place. That really sets the framework for everything that Norman just talked about, how you have openness and transparency and yet protect the interests of Homeland Security, national security, and proprietary business information. We went from the worst case scenario process, including a horrendous rulemaking process, to dealing with cybersecurity and risk management in the early Clinton administration. And during those days, Richard Clark, who many of you may remember as being part of the National Security Council staff, kept talking about the vulnerability of information and the lack of information sharing and the need to protect the infrastructure. Come 2001, everybody was saying belatedly what Richard Clark was talking about. And we looked at information policies immediately post 9/11 that provided a barrier to information sharing. This is before the reports, before the 9/11 commission. Where'd Dan go? He and his staff and the policy office immediately identified controls on information that we had helped put into place that maybe should be rethought. In the meantime, conversations were going on about a systemic way of addressing the barriers to information sharing. And being good lawyers, we put on our policy hats and tried to figure out how to change laws and policies. What eventually became the, what Dan calls SHIZI, Sensitive Homeland Security Information, was enacted into law 2002. And people at the Justice Department and Homeland Security and the White House and the National Security Council tried to figure out what it meant to improve information sharing while protecting sensitive information sharing. At the same time, I was the chief of staff and deputy director of what was perhaps the first publicly known federal fusion center, the Foreign Terrorism Tracking Task Force, that was intended to bring together the data of all of the law enforcement agencies in the Department of Justice, related information from all of the other agencies, particularly that related to immigration data. And I immediately found people who couldn't care less what the law said, what the policy was, and what do you mean the Privacy Act prevents it? The operational imperatives led to, in some fusion, a lot of technology, and more confusion than clarity about sharing information. It was then that I understood for the first time the power of a GS-11 to thwart the policy desires of the White House, the Attorney General, the Director of the FBI. And it's why, although the law is important, when we talk about the effort to create reform of what we call controlled unclassified information and all of the steps we went through, the thing that is most important and most clear is that it really doesn't matter what the law says. If you can't change the culture, and people will not share, whether they are corporate entities or government agencies or individuals within government agencies, unless they're confident that their information interests will be protected. We have more laws that I'll tee up Matt now. Matt and I actually co-chaired with a Department of Justice official, the first working group on what became controlled unclassified information. And it was that group that compiled the list of 107 laws. And I just really depressed Matt because I pulled out, we had trouble understanding. I had been working with this issue of information policy and management for about 20 years when I became one of the co-chairs for this working group. And the first thing I discovered was there were the FOIA people and the FISMA people and the privacy people and the technology people and the security people. And they did not speak the same language. The laws under which they acted bore little or no relationship to one another. And most of the operational personnel, those who needed the data, received the data, and processed the data, had no understanding whatsoever of the interplay and worked off of 3x5 cards when we had come up with an extraordinarily complex computer program trying to differentiate all of the different, even Dan made a little mistake, where is he, safeguarding information, access and dissemination requirements and prohibitions, what the safeguarding considerations were, what the security requirements were, and what the special handling requirements are. I've concluded that it was impossible to comply with all of these complex laws. I never before in 30 years said it is impossible to come into compliance with the four corners of these laws and policies. The current system is dysfunctional, expensive, unsustainable, and serves neither our security nor the concept of openness and access to information adequately. And when I left, I am so glad that Matt and others, with greater patience, once again picked up the baton to rationalize an incredibly irrational system. You're on, Matt.
Terrific. Well, first of all, you have to realize that anything Grace says with regard to me or any happiness in handing this over to me is merely reaffirming her own earlier decisions because she hired me at DHS. First, I want to say thanks to the Washington College for hosting this event, Washington College of Law, and to Dan for the invitation to come and speak on CUI, which is, as you just heard from Grace, a subject that I've devoted some time to in the past few years. A couple of points, I guess, that I'll throw out before I give a more formal overlay, which is that the SBU effort that we had undertaken in the time frame that Grace was just referring to in the, I guess it was 2004 and 5.
Three, four, and five.
Was the effort to identify and all of these various regimes that existed at the time and to come up with a goal of trying to pull them together if possible and for the management of information. But it was all being done within the context of what was becoming the information sharing environment. That is, it was all related to terrorism information. Subsequent to that effort in May of 2008, President Bush issued a memorandum with regard to the establishment of what's called controlled unclassified information. And you've heard the term used a lot, but I, as far as I know, that was the first formal effort to create that framework. And the purpose of it within the scope of the memo that the President issued was with regard to terrorism-related information in the information-sharing environment. That's significant, and you'll hear why more in a second. So my colleague Jay Basanko over here, who is at NARA and the executive agent for controlled and classified information, undertook at the time an extraordinary effort and is a great collaborator, communicator, interagency cooperator, and created this community of experts and representatives from various agencies responsible for implementing President Bush's memo on this subject. Come May of 2009, President Obama directed the Attorney General and the Secretary of DHS to establish an interagency task force on the subject of controlled and classified information. You heard I was honored to represent Secretary Napolitano on this task force, and I was fortunate to have a colleague, Candace Kelly, who is a senior counsel at the Department of Justice, representing the Attorney General. And together, we undertook to gather the agencies and assess this thing called CUI. And let me tell you, read to you essentially what the task was that President Obama directed our leaders that we should do. The task was to determine whether current procedures for categorizing and sharing sensitive but unclassified information strike the proper balance among the imperatives of protecting legitimate security, law enforcement, and privacy interests, as well as civil liberties, providing clear rules to those who handle sensitive but unclassified information, and ensuring that the handling and dissemination is not restricted unless there is a compelling need. Additionally, we were to consider measures to track progress with implementing CUI, with implementing the framework, other measures to enhance implementation, and significantly, whether to expand the scope of CUI beyond terrorism information or terrorism-related information that's within the information sharing environment and apply it to all sensitive but unclassified information. And this is where, when you make that transition, that's where really you kick the door open on the number of regimes that you're talking about, the number of different programs in the government, because then you've abandoned those things that may have a national security interest or other homeland security related interest, and you're talking about any information in the possession of the government for which there is a need to protect it or to manage its dissemination. And that includes information that's about all of us, information in Social Security records, information in Health and Human Services Agency records, because those records contain privacy-related information, and so that would be included in that concept. The task force was given by the President 90 days to perform this small effort, and what we did was we called upon the participation of 14 agencies. We gathered, we met, and thank you, Jay Basanko, who offered, and we agreed to be hosted at the National Archives, which made sense because that's where so much of the work had done been done already on implementing the CUI framework. And we started off reviewing everything that had been done already, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of reports, some of which were written by people in this room, on the current state of play. And we looked at also the particular procedures that are in use by various agencies where we wanted to look at the actual procedures. And we then realized that as the discussions proceeded, a couple of things became clear fairly early, which was each of us, as is no surprise, but nonetheless, sometimes you have to have it happen to you, each of us came at the discussion from the perspective that we knew best and oftentimes didn't realize that there were other perspectives. And so, you know, from my perspective, I'm expert, I would say, in national security information and the management of national security, whether classified or not, in the national security processes. We realized immediately, and there were a number of people with that expertise. What we needed to do, though, was to bring in people who knew about things that were just the opposite. And we reached out to find what are the opposite, what are the things we have no idea about. And so we called HHS, we called Social Security Administration, we called education, we called all these other agencies and said, would you please come and meet with us and tell us what you do with information that needs protection. What kind of information do you use? What kind? What do you do with it? How do you protect it? What do you need to do with your information? And we needed to really become educated about all of this. And so that fits in with the fact that we then we held consultation meetings with everyone we could think of, frankly. And this was among the most valuable things that we could do, in addition to just then discussing the ideas, because we needed to be well informed in this effort. And so, in addition to meeting with the body that Jay Bosanko leads, the CUI Council, we also met with the program offices of a number of particular programs. For example, in President Bush's memo, he called out the Protected Critical Infrastructure Information Program and some others as being particularly sensitive and needing to make sure that as we went forward, we didn't upset those programs, that they still functioned effectively despite other efforts at implementing this effort. So we met with them to hear what their concerns were. We met more agencies outside of the information sharing environment, Critical Infrastructure Partnership Council, National Industrial Security Program Advisory Committee. We met in what was one of my favorite meetings, frankly. We met with the open government advocacy groups. And that was a very meaningful meeting, and I think that when my colleagues on this panel read the report, they can probably identify a few things they taught me in that meeting. And so that was very valuable. We met with representatives of state, local, and tribal government entities. We met with congressional staffers. We were going to meet with a congressperson, but she wasn't available. We met with the Office of National Drug Control Policy. The National Security Council Senior Director for Records and Access Management, who, under the direction, the same memo from President Obama, was doing a review of Executive Order 12958 on the management of classified national security information. And so we met to discuss what are you doing, what are the issues, what are the concerns, are there areas that we can benefit, from each other's best practices, are there areas where we should try not to, things like that. We met with the Privacy Committee of the Federal CIO Council, Federal CIO Council leadership. So really, we did all we can in the 90 days that we had to take in as much information as possible. And we sat out and we held, and then we also had these regular meetings over at NARA with these interagency representatives. And we had a number of goals. I mean, first of all, one of them was to make sure that we didn't do any harm as we were doing this. That is, there are a number of programs, despite the benefits and despite the fact that it may be a mess if you look at the totality of programs and say there are all these different regimes for managing information. Am I out of time already? All right. you might look at the totality and conclude that it's a mess, because it is. But if you look at an individual program, any one individual program, you might look at that program and say, not a mess. Some programs more than others. For example, a couple of the programs that we called out in the report as exemplars of well-done programs are quite well done. That is, they take into account in their existing rules everything that we set out to do in CUI. They have effective training, they have effective oversight, they have clear policies, they say they don't over-control or under-control, they have clear guidance regarding dissemination. So very good programs. And so we didn't want to screw that up. We wanted to make sure that as we tried to build a framework that would bring everybody else up to speed, we didn't undo anything that was already good. Additionally, so that was a critical issue for us to make sure, and we kept that in mind. That also caused us to and led that goal and the fact that we reached out to these agencies to learn what they do with the information led to one of the most important recommendations of the report. And that one had to do, in my opinion, with ensuring flexibilities are built into the system in order to accommodate what an agency's real mission is and what the agency does with information. That is, we realize that despite the fact that there's a mess and that we have a desire to make it neater and have things more structured and organized, that even within that, there needs to be variation because you can't take the same set of rules and apply it to how an agency that does, you know, maybe handles bulk data in processing, you know, checks that they send to people every month or something, and that data doesn't really go anywhere besides into this data bank, makes the checks, goes to the printer, and it disappears. It doesn't really go anywhere. So you don't want to have the same set of rules for that as you have when you're creating a rule for, I've now written an intelligence report that is unclassified but sensitive, and I'm going to have to put, you know, CUI on the top and the bottom and paragraph mark. These are two very different examples of types of sensitive but unclassified information, and so there had to be flexibility to allow for these rules, and this that came out of recognizing that and really drilling down into what agencies do with their data. And lastly, scope, the scope of CUI. This was an interesting issue for discussion because...
Am I good? Please move to...
Okay, so most important recommendations.
Those?
All right, so I'm actually starting that now. So the expansion of the scope, one of the issues that the president asked that this task force look at is whether or not the scope should be expanded to all information beyond terrorism-related information. And as we started that off, those discussions, some agencies spoke up and said not only do they believe that we should recommend that, but they're going to do it anyway. Regardless of what's recommended, they're going to do that because they think it's the right decision. And that started discussions on this. It was, generally speaking, a lot of support for the idea of expanding it because the recognizing the need to have better and clearer and consistent rules. It wasn't unanimous in that. That was the one issue that we didn't reach unanimity on. But by and large, well, not by and large, it was absolutely, in my opinion, the right way to go. And that was a recommendation. And then other important recommendations that we made. Simplifying the definition of CUI. This was critical because the definition from President Bush's memo from 2008 had a more complex definition, partially based upon the narrowness of the field to which it was going to apply. By expanding the scope of CUI, it was actually easier to make a more simple definition, and so that was one of the things that we did. We expanded the scope of the framework. Clarifying the role of the executive agent was one of the important things that we did, one of the important recommendations, I should say, that the task force did, and that is recognizing that how this whole thing is going to play out is going to require cooperative effort between agencies and the executive agent that manages it. We needed to make sure we recommended that the executive agent clearly have the responsibility to do these things, but that he understand the need to take it seriously, the agency requirements, and that the agencies understand the need to work with the executive agent. And now coming back to my meeting with others on this table, at the table today, clarifying that the CUI label has no bearing on release of under FOIA or releases to the Congress was a very important recommendation and something that was strongly advocated for in our meeting and in your report. And thank you. Lastly, the need for effective agency training and oversight. Grace mentioned earlier the fact that the most important thing in doing this is not about what the law says, but changing culture. And so we believe that that training program, effective training programs and oversight programs are going to be critical for changing that culture. that's it. We met, we wrote a report, we delivered it to the White House on August 25th, and that's the end of me. So.
Thank you. I'm going to speak a little bit about NARA's role and our perspective. The National Archives and Records Administration first became involved in CUI in the lead up to the 2008 memo. At that time, there was interest in having certain functions assigned to an executive agent. Many of those functions, when folks identified them, lined up almost perfectly with ISOO's existing functions for the classification system. So the idea was to have an ISOO-like entity. So one of the first places folks turned was National Archives. National Archives was also approached because we're not a significant player in the creation of any of the categories of information. So we're sort of viewed as a more neutral party as far as agencies being comfortable with an executive agent. So we became involved in that, but we've been dealing with these issues for decades. Agencies apply markings to their records. The records get transferred to the National Archives, and we've been seeing these markings and have been challenged by these markings for many years. From May of 2008, though, when the memo came out, we established a CUI office. We've stood it up originally with detailees, some contractor support, and I'd just like to recognize, I've got six or seven folks here, guys, if you all just quickly stand up. All right, come on, stand up, don't be shy. In that row right now, you have a combination of federal employees, detailees from other government agencies, and contractors that have supported this office. So we built that capability right from the start in May of 2008 and started implementing that memo. We didn't have a choice when it was issued. It had a tight response, a tight deadline, and we had to start moving forward. But, of course, as has been mentioned and everyone's aware, in May of 2009, the Obama administration issued a memo calling for a critical examination. And I think it's worth just taking a minute, and Sharon used the word historical, that we were going to provide a historical perspective. It's frustrating but intriguing all at the same time that what we're talking about is a historical perspective on essentially a reform effort. We have not yet met with success, but this is something that, you know, has been churning for quite some time. But I think the task force, actually, and a lot of credit goes to Matt Cronish and Candace Kelly, because in that 90-day time period, and if you think about it, there's more than 100 markings, something that impacts most agencies in the government. It impacts the state, local, tribal entities, private sector entities. There was concerns from a FOIA perspective. There are public interest stakeholders. All of these different folks were touched by this. And as Grace alluded to, culture has been a big issue, very strong feelings about these issues. But in that 90-day period, Matt and Candace were able to lead a critical review of the policy and issue a report to the president, which is now continuing the CUI reform effort. Basically, though, once that effort began in 2009, we sort of put our policy piece under the May 2008 memo, sort of set it aside, focused initially on supporting the task force, and then in the period since the conclusion of the task force effort, we've been working to support the administration's overall effort to reform CUI policy, and that is the most appropriate phrase for what's going on. From a NARA perspective, what should that reform include? There's two absolutely critical things from a National Archives perspective that any CUI reform effort must touch upon. The first is the issue of decontrol. We have an accepted concept in this country that information sometimes needs to be withheld from the people, even though they have a need to have access to that information in order to hold the government accountable. American people are generally okay with that, provided they have a feel for how much of that activity is going on, where it's occurring, and they have an expectation and understanding that eventually the information will see the light of day and will be available. The CUI memo that came out in 2008 was absolutely silent as far as a decontrol scheme. From our perspective, it's critical. Otherwise, you have a classification system with national security information with clear deadlines at 25, 50, and 75 years for declassification. And then you have this other system which deals with less sensitive information, doesn't rise to a level of classification, which has essentially indefinite duration. The second thing from a National Archives perspective is that whatever policy comes out must have a clear statement, a distinction regarding the Freedom of Information Act. Paragraph 13 of the 2008 memo said that CUI markings may inform but do not control FOIA decisions. From our perspective, they're completely separate and distinct, and the CUI markings should have no bearing on FOIA decisions. The information that's being considered under FOIA needs to stand on its own merits, and decisions need to be made on a case-by-case basis and not contingent upon the markings. Just as important, from our perspective, whatever policy is advanced needs to be sufficiently flexible to enable progress versus seeking perfection. And from where I'm sitting, this has been one of the things that's held us back. We have a system that touches so many different categories of information, has such wide-ranging ramifications from an IT perspective, the impact on FOIA, the impact on existing agency policy and practices. You've got the cultural aspect. If we continue to hold out CUI reform to the point where everything is addressed to absolute perfection and satisfaction, we won't get anywhere. As John Podesta pointed out this morning, we can't allow the constraints of the past to rule our future. We need to put forth a policy which allows us to begin to move forward, a policy that supports regular examination of the policy and an opportunity to change it later if it's not working. But trying to achieve nirvana in a policy area that has largely been ungoverned for multiple decades, we're not going to get there. With any regime that's intended to safeguard information, it's absolutely important that folks have confidence in the system. And so from my perspective, one of the key elements of the reform effort is to bring legitimacy to the CUI system. At present, folks with inside government don't respect or have confidence in the system, and the American people lack a confidence in the system. So we need to bring some legitimacy to the system. In closing, there's a couple of key points that have been sort of woven throughout the process. Elements that have shown up in past policy issuances, things that many people that talk about CUI will touch upon. Safeguarding, terrorism, information sharing, openness and transparency. From my perspective, from National Archives' perspective, CUI reform is not any one of these. It's not about safeguarding. It's not about terrorism-related information. It's not about information sharing. It's not about openness and transparency, but rather it has to be, it must be, all of them. So in essence, what this is about and the perspective that the National Archives is taking in our role as executive agent is one of effective and efficient government. It's a good government perspective. If we get it right, all those other things, transparency, safeguarding, they will all come to play. But the status quo, a system with more than 100 markings, no clarity as to what those markings mean, absolute confusion in some quarters with respect to how to use those markings, that does not safeguard information. That does not ensure openness and transparency. And I think we can do a lot better.
Thank you. Thanks to the Washington College of Law for inviting me, and thanks to Matt and to Jay for incorporating the open government perspective into the work that you've done on this issue. I think that's been very valuable, and you're right, I could read in the report where things we said found their place into the report, so I appreciate the thought that you guys are putting into this, because this is a very difficult problem. And, you know, sometimes when wrestling with a difficult problem, it's best to try to articulate that problem. And I think that when I do that, it'll show where our concerns in the open government community lie. You know, basically the problem that I think Matt and Jay have both articulated well is that today we have an environment where government agents are using control markings on unclassified information that in a completely unregulated manner, as Jay said, that don't have legitimacy under the law, and that these control markings are impeding government sharing of unclassified information among government agencies, but also with Congress and the courts and with the public. So if the solution to that is to provide some legitimacy to the control markings so that we will have a legitimate system that allows control markings under the law that continue to impede information sharing among government agencies with Congress and the courts and the public, I'm not sure we've accomplished anything. And in fact, from our perspective, because in addition to lobbyists, the ACLU has litigators, and it's easier to attack a system in court that has no legitimacy and basis in the law than one that does. So, you know, as we're creating a system to create that legitimacy, we want to make sure that the goal of increasing information sharing, both within the agencies, with Congress, with courts, and with the public, is maintained in the forefront, because that's really the ultimate goal of a system like this. And, you know, the major problem and sort of the shorthand that we use in the open government community is that we don't want the CUI, the Controlled Unclassified Information regime, to be a fourth level of classification. And part of the reason for that is that the classification system has its own host of problems, as Jay well knows, as director of ISU. So you know, it's almost like we can look at what we don't want this regime to become. And Grace, I think, made a great point, and it's sort of the way I look at this type of issue, because I was that GS-11 FBI agent who was responsible for actually implementing the policy at the ground level, often without having a fraction of the understanding. I mean, even now, I don't think I have a fraction of the understanding of these policies that you have, and yet that's where it really means something, where that GS-11 is actually doing things on the ground. So, you know, part of it is to make sure the system is as simple for that person as possible. And when we look at the classification system, you know, one of the things that Jay's office puts out a report every year on sort of the state of secrecy, and one of the things that's interesting to note in last year's report is that although overall classification went up this is actually 2008, which is the last report that Jay's office has put out. Original classification done by original classifiers who were trained in what they're doing, went down significantly, 13%, if I recall. I have the report here. So how did original classification go down 13%, but total classification go up 1%.
Wait till you see next year's report.
And the answer is what they call derivative classification. And derivative classification is what the GS-11 is doing. And he is taking something that is classified by somebody well above his pay grade and has to figure out on his own, often with very little training, how to mark that document. And The information that they get is so bad. In fact, I'll read this to you. This is an FBI document we got in a FOIA, and it was about this national program that the FBI wanted to very quickly, in a classified program, interview a whole bunch of people across the United States. And in order to accomplish this, the FBI is made up of sort of two halves, one that does counterintelligence and international terrorism, and one that does criminal justice work. The criminal justice work, which is most of what I did, really doesn't deal very much in classified information, although they would deal considerably in this unclassified, controlled information environment. And what happened is they had to rush this out, so they had to get a lot of these people who weren't dealing with classified documents up to speed on how to mark the documents properly. So there was some confusion, and there were memos going back and forth trying to explain it, and this is finally what it went out to the field. And what we're talking about is interview reports, which in the FBI's parlance are FD-302s. So when I use the term FD-302, just imagine an interview report. Some field offices contacted FBI headquarters and voiced confusion over this guidance. The confusion involves referring to FD-302s with a classified case number as an unclassified 302, or referencing the subfile containing classified 302s as an unclassified subfile. It was not the intention of headquarters to suggest that the FD-302 would not be classified or that the subfile containing classified documents is unclassified. Due to the classified file number on the FD-302, it would be a classified document. However, the body of the 302 can and should contain unclassified information. Thus, the FD-302 was being referred to as the unclassified FD-302. More appropriately, the FD-302 should have been referred to as, quote, the classified FD-302 with the unclassified body. To ensure that FD-302s are handled properly, the following additional guidance is provided. The FD-302 should be classified appropriately as secret, as well as have the following caveat. All information contained herein is unclassified. So this is an environment that is heavily regulated, that has been around for a long time, that is pretty much generally understood, and this is the kind of advice that gets. So now we move that out into a system.
The feds on the panel all understand exactly what you just said.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
What don't you get?
There's a reason why it's the Federal Bureau.
Yes, bureaucracy is their middle name. But we're talking about exponentially expanding what documents can be marked. And if the agent, because I can tell you exactly what happened here, even though I wasn't involved in this case, this was after I left the FBI, is that every document got marked secret, and the agent said, here's what I know. If I mark it unclassified and it gets out, I go to jail. If I mark it classified and it shouldn't be, nobody's going to come after me and say a thing. So I'm just going to mark everything classified, and that's why we have this huge problem where experts say somewhere between 50 and 90% of classified documents are overclassified. So if we have that same system in this regime, and if this regime becomes known as a document security regime, that those agents are going to make the same determination, and they're going to look at the top of the page and see a mark and say, I'm not going to take the chance of getting in trouble. This document's going to stay in my drawer under lock and key and not get out where it needs to be. And, I appreciate the work that Matt and Jay are doing. I think that they understand our concerns. I'm not pretending that this is going to be an easy problem to solve. But I think we do have to make sure that, what I think would be valuable in the end is to have a regime where when an agent looks down on the page and sees the CUI marking, what he'll recognize is, this is something my agency wants me to get out. I obviously have to review it to understand what the concern is, but my agency expects me to share this document. And I should be sharing this with my partners in law enforcement or the other agencies, and I have to, take some care to make sure that I'm doing it in an appropriate way. But this isn't something that should be sitting in my desk. And if we can turn this regime into that, I think it can be successful both for giving the government the best use of the information that it has, but also for increasing the amount of information sharing both in the government and to the Congress, to the courts, and to the American public.
Thank you. Okay, I want to allow time for Q&A, and I know we have another panel coming up, so I'm going to tell my panelists I have a question for each of you before we open it up to the audience, but they're going to be short questions, hopefully with short answers, so then we can get everybody else involved and coming up to the microphones to ask your own questions and shortly. Go in the same order again. Now, Grace, now that you're on the outside of government and looking back at this effort, do you have a particular tip or lesson learned that you would like to share with your colleagues who are still working on this from the inside?
Success through patience. The most important thing is to continue to push for what every panelist has talked about, because the goals are common And my major concern is that the executive agent lacks the adequate resources, staff, budget, appropriations, and technical support to make the positive vision possible. It was the problem with before I left government, and I can't imagine in the current economy it's gotten any better. And the governance structure will, and the effectiveness of it, is what will make the difference, and make the difference between the default position of bury it and it's safe, and performance management that really drives culture change to achieve what is the common vision among the panelists.
Okay, Matt, I was going to ask you what the greatest obstacles are you see, but from so many speakers, it sounds like a lot of it is this need for a culture change that so many speakers, including Norm Eisen, have talked about. What are your thoughts on how best to achieve that culture change along with the rules change that your task force worked on?
One of the recommendations were included in the report, I don't remember if it was an explicit recommendation, was the importance of agency leadership responsibility or agency leadership accountability for implementing the CUI framework within the agency. That is, they have to get it and they have to buy it and they should get training. They should be trained on it to begin with by Jay Bosenko's office so that they get it from the source. And then they need to be accountable in how it's implemented within their agencies.
Which leads right into the question for Jay. As you move forward with implementation and continuing work on this, are you getting a lot of pushback from a lot of the agencies involved? Yes. And would you like to speak to that issue of how that's working?
Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about here is significant change. And never mind the discussions earlier about defining significant. But we're talking about modifying behavior that has gone on quite literally for several decades. So there's a lot of, I don't know if pushback is really it, but I'd say more angst. There's a lot of concern. What will this mean for my agency? How will I meet with success within my agency? How will I train my workforce? Right now, there's a really big, there's a pretty broad spectrum as far as what agencies provide their personnel, what kind of regulations they have in place, what kind of training, what kind of oversight capability they have. So there's a lot of angst. And getting back to Mike's point as well, I mean, I think one of the things we're trying to do is to keep the system simple, to make it implementable. But of course, when we're dealing with the interagency, there's a tendency to look at the very unique situation that they're facing and imagine all of the ways that this could be problematic and then want us to build into the policy all the possible relief pieces. One of the biggest challenges we face is IT. How do you deal with new requirements in IT infrastructure that's not exactly lean and agile? So there's a lot of concerns there. We're trying to keep the policy simple, start advancing it forward, and support the agencies that way.
Mike, you've talked a lot about trying to make sure that this reform effort will promote information sharing rather than more safeguarding and creating a fourth level of classification. What in particular would you like to see in whatever executive order or further document comes out of the administration that would move this in that direction?
I think Jay mentioned some things that we've brought up before, decontrol, accountability as far as who's making the markings. It really has to go beyond just a statement that a marking isn't determinative under a FOIA request. And this is where I think it gets most difficult, because if this becomes a document security regime, most of the exemptions under FOIA are because there is some sort of regulation, law, or policy that says this is not publicly releasable. So if those become the criteria for a marking, what the very tired FOIA guy who's got a pile of paper there, when he sees that marking, he'll say, well, somebody already determined that this document shouldn't be released to the public, so I don't have to review this very closely. I can move on to the next page and just sort of second the previous person's. And he's the one creating it, so he probably has a better idea of why this needs to be out. But, you know, sort of create this perception that somebody has marked it because it is exempt under one of the exemptions would lead to more or less disclosure under FOIA.
Okay, I see we have somebody starting to line up the microphones. If anyone else who does have a question wants to also line up at microphones, but and if you could please identify yourself before you ask your question, and if you could please actually ask a question.
I'll happily comply with the former. I'm Whitfield Diffie from the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford and the EPIC Board of Directors. And I don't really want to ask a question. I want to make four brief comments and ask for comments on those. I came to this panel particularly because I'm very concerned about sub-classification markings of the time you're discussing. As a person who spent his career trying to find things out, my observation is that FOUO is half to three-quarters as effective in keeping people from telling me something as secret or top secret. And the critical difference in my mind is that under the Internal Security Act of 1950, which started, and some other laws that started this regime, classification authority is specified and limited. Authority to write other sorts of restrictive markings on documents seems to be available willy-nilly. And in the sake of time, I won't put in a few other comments, but that
Thank
I
you.
Want to know if you agree with me that that is the critical point, is the classification authority needs to be limited.
Do you mind? From my perspective, the points you just made are exactly why we're seeking to reform the system. Right now, anybody can apply these markings at some agencies. Other agencies actually tie them back to the FOIA and tell their personnel, apply FOUO if the information would meet one of the criteria for exemption under the FOIA. But they never train their personnel in how to make those kind of decisions. So we have markings that really have no meaning. There was, you know, a good intent behind them, but you know, my favorite, you know, it's a glib comment, but what do we not do in government that's not for official use? I mean, the marking itself is somewhat absurd, and we have markings like FOUO that the person that applied that marking, it meant something to them. But then they give that information to others, to include me, and they haven't told me anything about what that marking means, how I'm supposed to work with it. So it's absurd. We have a system right now that's chaos, okay? What we're attempting to do with this reform effort is to take a complete lack of a structure, lack of a framework, lack of things like required training, authorities as to who can apply markings, a lack of oversight, and build a framework for it. Is it going to be perfect? I can't promise you much today, but I can guarantee you that it won't be perfect. But it's going to provide much more rigor than we've ever had before, and I think we'll be able to address those kinds of things.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Whit, and in fact, I probably agree with what you didn't say. So, yeah. But you know, and that's just it. And if these markings start to either under the policy or in practice start to basically be that same determination by the person marking it, is there a FOIA exemption that would have prevented this from going out, then even though the policy says it's not determinative to the FOIA officer, it's going to influence the FOIA officer, and that's the problem.
I should have made the point, both in response to Mike and to you, sir, and to other pieces that we've talked about. We have a requirement or an obligation, if you will, to develop training. We've already begun sort of some baseline training that can be deployed to all agencies. One of the things we've committed to doing is building a special training module that would be deployed to FOIA officers to make sure that they are aware of what the CUI framework is and isn't. Probably more importantly, the isn't.
Yeah, right.
Teresa?
Yes. Thank you, and thanks to all of you for the panel and for the hard work that you're doing. We do appreciate it. In addition to the points that Mike made in terms
of everybody else, even though I know who you are.
Oh, who I am? Oh, I'm sorry, Patrice McDermott, OpenTheGovernment.org. In addition to the points that Mike made about the concerns of the open government community, I would add another one. In addition to, you know, ensuring information sharing and those sorts of things, one of the big concerns that we have is to minimize the use of these markings, not just to codify what they are, but to actually reduce the usage of them across the government. And even though the President's directions to the task force said to consider whether this should be expanded to the other regimes and to information outside the ISE, by expanding it that way, you open up, it seems to us, the real risk that this is going to, that these markings are going to proliferate. Even if people know what they mean, they're going to get put on everything. Patrice, and there's not going to be anything that's not marked.
I couldn't disagree with you more. Right now, those markings are being, you know, used. They're proliferating on their own. Just in the last couple months, we've seen agencies coming up with new markings. I saw a DOD solicitation the other day that said you had to have a need to know to work with their CUI, which is a concept from the classification system. So all of this activity is going on without anything. If we expand the CUI framework to include all information that's sensitive, then the oversight and all the rule sets apply across the board. And we can begin to rein in that activity, oversee it, make sure it fits standards. If we keep the CUI framework limited to terrorism-related information within the information sharing environment, the first thing is that doesn't sound like a mission for the National Archives. The second thing is it will allow the status quo to remain. You'll have all of that chaos. I don't see how that gets what you need.
I think we disagree, because I think if the FOIA regime, the privacy regime, all those others come under it, and anything that, as Mike says, this is something my agency wants me to share with other people, what doesn't that include? What doesn't get marked CUI at some level?
I just want to stress that. So FOIA and Privacy Act are not part of this, totally separate and distinct. So these are markings that agencies are already applying. Those 107, 124,
right,
depending which list you use, markings are already being used with no controls.
Not likely to say CUI exemption, blah, blah, a FOIA exemption.
Absolutely not. Will not in any way, shape, or form. What it will do is take that list of 100 plus,
mm-hmm,
winnow it
which
down.
Which includes some FOIA exemptions, actually.
We're going to winnow it down to a small group that apply commonly across the executive branch,
mm-hmm,
define them in a publicly available register that anybody will be able to access and understand what they mean, and then those agencies will then be limited to the use of those markings, none others, and then if there are those few instances where there's a marking that's unique to an agency, they would have to come in. And then all of the usage of that will be subject to oversight, training requirements. Agencies are going to be required to have their own oversight capability, training capability, things like that.
And here's my concern with that, kind of picking up on what Patrice said, is that if we're turning this into a regime where everything that can possibly be restricted in dissemination should be marked up front, we're going to have
doing that today, though, Mike. They're
But that's not true. I mean, in the FBI, everything that I touched was restricted for at least a certain matter of time, even if it was evidence that was ultimately going to be turned over to a jury at some point and become public. At the point that I was using it in the investigation, it was restricted in dissemination. So if I mark every single one of the, I mean, basically what document wouldn't be marked in the FBI?
One of the things that
currently marked as law enforcement sensitive information, which is a meaningless term that no one, including no one in the FBI, defines or governs. And law enforcement sensitive information is used within just the Department of Justice by the law enforcement agencies totally differently. And Lord, I mean, I spent 30 years trying to get each of the agencies to tell me what it meant.
Right.
They came up with different answers.
Right.
You can't enforce and share information. I mean,
But I would argue, and in my experience there, what was marked were things that were going to be shared with other law enforcement agencies. My investigative files were never marked with anything, even though it often contained 6E information.
I'm not sure when you left, but at one point, the 302s were given to the Foreign Terrorism Tracking Task Force. They were just the 302s that related to immigration, intelligence, counterintelligence, and drug trafficking. And they were all marked law enforcement sensitive and with mark that they couldn't go into a database to be shared with other law enforcement agencies.
But two points, real quick. One, the intent is not to mark anything and everything, no matter where it exists. Matt made reference earlier to there are, you know, we all get, you know, the Social Security Administration processes tons of checks. All that data is flowing through a system to generate those checks. It doesn't need to be marked as it's, you know, going through that. There will be a rationalization applied to the use of the markings that's appropriate to the environment that it's used. But moreover, anytime there is a marking, there's going to be a standardized decontrol period that applies when the marking goes away. Right now, those markings are applied, and they essentially mean forever and ever, amen, until you go back to that originating agency. Now you're going to have a system where it may say restricted, but 5 years later, that marking means nothing.
Okay, and let me just throw this out on Patrice's comment, that the other thing is that there shouldn't be any penalties in this program for dissemination that go beyond the penalties that already exist. In other words, that a marking doesn't increase the penalties for somebody sharing information with somebody they shouldn't have. If it was Privacy Act protected information that they shared, the Privacy Act has severe penalties that go along with that. But if we want this to be a document sharing regime, if there are penalties associated with sharing it.
But we don't view it as a sharing regime. We don't see it as a safeguard. I mean, it comes down to basic good government. But I will say on the penalties issue, from our perspective at least, there needs to be a balancing of any sanctions or penalties. There needs to be an equal sanction if you over control than if you send something someplace it shouldn't.
Right.
All right. We're going to have to. This goes to the heart of this, and this is fabulous. But we have another panel that wants to get on at 4. We have two people who have been sitting here very patiently. If you could each come up and quickly ask a short question, and we'll see if the panelists can then take both of them together and we can get you quick answers because you've been very patient. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. My name is LaSoya Lang. I'm with CGS. I just want to thank you all for coming today. My question is for Mr. Basenko and Mr. Cronish. My question is if and when there will be an executive order issued, and the second part of my question is whether or not you'll be willing to take public comments before the issuance of the executive order.
Okay, that's question one. Go ahead.
Michael Binder from the Air Force. Are you going to identify people in the agencies who are going to be the recognized experts on these CUI terms? Because we get phone calls for assistance, and we're not even the one-eyed men in the land of the blind.
Okay.
With regard to the first question, I'm sorry to say that in order to get an answer, you'll need to call the White House, because the White House is responsible for issuing executive orders. Neither NARA nor Matt Cronish. The second question, I'm going to defer to Jay on the second, sure, because it's more in your lane.
Well, actually, on the first, a year ago to this day, I sat in that chair over there, and Dan asked me when something might be coming out from the White House, and my response was, it's imminent. That was in March, and the memo came out in May, so I learned my lesson.
That's a very transparent admission.
As far as when, I can tell you that from my perspective, my personal perspective, as well as I think the perspective of the National Archives, it's something that we hope will be coming out in the near future, because as you can tell, there's a lot of critical issues that need to be worked. As far as identifying key folks, yes, in each agency there will be a need for a responsible organization entity that will have to manage this. Agencies will be responsible for training their personnel. They will be responsible for writing regulations on this issue, and they will be responsible for overseeing their own personnel's behavior. So it's something that has to happen with some form of centralization and responsibility.
Okay, if you please join me in thanking our panelists. We'll get the next panel up here.
Karen,
this will be. On time, Dan.
This will be very quick. I appreciate that. We have One quick question from someone in the audience who's too, she was too shy to ask it, but all it requires is a single number from each of the five of you. And the question is, when that process of winnowing down from, we have 124 listed on our website, of safeguarding labels is complete, what number do you think it will or should be? What number will it be winnowed down to? Just one digit from each of the five of you very quickly. What number of categories will it be winnowed down to at the end of the day?
Four.
Four.
Matt? No exceptions.
He's too far from the mic. We're not
actually
picking that up.
I think that the real issue, given that we're in a law school, let me give an answer that actually goes along the lines of this.
Sharon has to make an appointment.
You're missing the point. It's not about the actual number. It's about the fact that whatever that number is, that number will reflect a framework that is consistent to them all and is available to the public, so that they know, so that the public knows, and other government officials who receive this information know what the standards are for handling and disseminating and utilizing this information. And so less important to me is the number than the framework.
We'll mark that down as more than four, either five or more, five plus. Sharon, what should it be?
I would actually agree with Matt's point that the number 107 or 124, whatever it is a symptom of the problem and not the actual problem. And I will just say I will hope for a single-digit number, but again, that's the symptom. That's not.
Single-digit. Jay, you're in a position to predict, but you might not be comfortable saying.
I was going to say, because then I might be tempted to influence the eventual outcome.
Yes.
But I will tell you that what we've done is we've looked at roughly a dozen that are commonly used across agencies, and we know there'll be some exceptions, I'm sure, to that. So I'm going to go with a higher number. I'm going to say roughly around 18. Now, this isn't levels. This is flavors of CUI, because there will be probably a need to know the difference between the fact that there's PII in one document and UCNI in another. You can't just put it behind a blind label.
So we have four, five plus, single digit, optimistically, 18 perhaps, maybe fewer. And final one, Mike.
Well, I think Jay knows far more than I do, so I'll go with 18 official and plus 117 unofficial markings.
Very good note. Thank you, folks.